Today is April 12, 2017, and welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original Personal Computer Radio Show, and I'm Hank Key. My colleague is Joe King, who is on remote tonight. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time and on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, broadcasting atop the Empire State Building. We live stream the BAI broadcast on WBAI.org. Our website is PCRadioshow.org. Hey, Joe, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine, Hank, and I wonder how everybody else there is, because I hear that last week, or perhaps also the week before that, there was a little bit of problem with the broadcast here on PRN. And I wanted to remind everybody that at PCRadioshow.org, we do keep an archive of all our back shows that are from WBAI.FM, and they're pretty much the same.
Yes, and Joe, you know, I just want to tell the audience why you're on remote, because, you know, today is a beautiful New York day, sunny, in the 70s, and I can just imagine you have your foot on top of the ottoman drinking your tequila.
I'm not really wild about tequila. The cerveza is very good here.
Hey, you know, the big news this week on computing is, and a lot of people are not even aware of it, is Windows 10 Creators. It's newly released yesterday, April 11th, and Microsoft has begun to roll it out. And let's talk about first some of the new things in it. And I'm not really excited about some of the new things because it's such a... It's like under the radar, but, you know, the Paint program, and I want to see how they do it, but I'm not anxious to see it right now, that if you draw a two-dimensional object, it can extrapolate it into a three-dimensional object in seconds. And I guess this is to tie it in with virtual reality and augmented reality, you know, the Xbox games and so on.
That's exactly right, Hank. I'm looking at it right now on my laptop. And the new draw program is primarily built so that you can create a virtual reality document to play back, whether you have the Samsung or the Acer or the Xbox. It'll handle them all.
And I think the big thing with the Windows 10 Creators is that Microsoft Edge, which is their browser, is more battery and resource efficient than Chrome. One of the things that that has not changed is battery technology. So everyone is optimizing programs and redesigning hardware so that there's a longer period between recharging of the battery. And
the basic physics of the battery is the same that it was in the last century.
Yeah. And by the way, do you know why they called the Windows 10 Creators this version?
Because it's been more created?
No, because they're saying, gee, we made it so good that now people who are creators will be using it. Come on, that's a lot of BS, you know that?
Certainly is, but you left out what to me is the key and probably most important major change in Creator, Windows 10 Creator from the previous edition.
Yes and no, because what happened was that when the anniversary edition came out last year in July, people were complaining that it was being pushed out and they were getting updates. And about 2-3 months ago, Microsoft said, oh, no, now you will have the option of saying, when do you want it updated? However, as you know, Microsoft giveth and Microsoft taketh, and there's nothing to stop them from pushing this creator's version out, you know, onto you, the user.
Well, until you talked to me about it, Hank, I was totally unaware of it. So just today, actually, I went online to see what I could find out about it. And I found out that it is now available, and if I wanted to be one of the first ones to receive it, all I had to do was check the box here, and I did check the box, but it hasn't come down yet.
You know, one of the things I do want to talk about is that I really don't mind updates, except that I find that with much of the software that's being updated, especially with from Microsoft, is that they change the navigation. As you probably know, you know, people who are running Android, they, you know, you could attest to that. When they come from one version to the other, I don't mind them doing updates, but when they change the navigation, you sit there and say, well, what do I do next? What, you know, I have no idea what they're doing.
Well, on the creator, they changed one part of the navigation that I really like a great deal. I'm totally in favor of. I don't need a password.
I got news for you. I don't need a password in the anniversary version, the way I run it.
Well, the way you run it?
Yep.
Can you just look at it and they'll know it's you?
Oh, okay. You're talking about password in terms of facial recognition. I'm talking about no password at all, which is what the way I run it.
But I don't want no password at all. I don't want my people who are coming over and looking at my computer can just open it up and do whatever they want. But on the other hand, I have so many passwords. I checked the other day, Hank. I have over 500 passwords.
Well, we'll get to that. Now, you know what? If they push it out, meaning you have no option to say no to the updates, I want to ask you a simple question because I want everyone to be aware of it. No more lip service, no more procrastination, time to back up, create restore points. By the way, Joe, I guess you do backups every day?
Oh, I do them whenever they're needed.
Yeah, you're going to tell me you do it every day Jupiter time, right?
Every day what?
According to the revolutions of the planet Jupiter, right? Not Earth time, right?
No. I do it, Hank, any time I believe it's needed.
Yeah. No, seriously.
Actually, the funny thing is, not funny, but I got a real glitch on my system yesterday, and I called you up all a panic. Why is this not working? I used the Windows key. I used the Windows on the screen. I couldn't get up my startup menu. I couldn't get it. And you said to me, that's all right, Joe. Just restore from your last backup.
And you said, huh? What did you say?
And I said, how do I do that? And I've never done a backup.
Yeah, okay. Well, I do backups, but, you know, seriously, because of the way Microsoft is now pushing things out, whether you want it or not, you really need backup because you could be doing something very critical, very serious, and there's nothing wrong with having updates, but when they change navigation and you are in a rush on a project to get it out, changing the navigation is terrible, you know, because I remember when the Microsoft changed the navigation on Office. They went from the drop-down menu to the ribbon menu. It was driving everyone crazy. Like, just to do a simple thing like copy and paste, where do I go? What do I do, you know? So it's really, make sure you create a bunch of restore points you can go back to because when they do a push or you do an update to creators or Windows 10 creators and you want to go back to the anniversary version or even to your current original version of build 1511, you want to make sure it's available. And you know what? You also should be testing these restore points. You know, just because you set restore points doesn't mean that they work. Because
yesterday was a case in point, Hank. You walked me through doing the restore. The last restore point I had was early in March. I think it was March 3rd or something. And it ran through. I clicked on it the way you told me to, and it ran through. After about 15, 20 minutes, it stopped, and then it upped a message saying it couldn't complete it. It was something was wrong. And that was the only restore point I had. I just took a chance. I did a reboot, and everything came up fine the way it was supposed to. But I only had that one restore point.
And you had a big lump in your throat when you did that. Go ahead, Joe.
The problem is you said that you might want to go back to the anniversary edition. Well, back on Windows XP and on Windows 7, which I'm used to running both of those, I knew how to find out which edition of Windows I was running. But they've changed that in Windows 10, and I went to the system page, it doesn't tell me anything about what I am running.
Well, you know, at least with Android, they go in alphabetic sequence, the fruits, okay? In the old days of Windows, you know, 3.1 went to 95 to, 2000 and X, you know, at least you could see the sequence. Today, the way Windows is being done, or by the way, I just want to make sure that everyone is aware that this update is free, okay, is that they come up with names like Anniversary, names like Creator. The next one is called Redstone, and you don't know which is the latest anymore. This is as bad as Intel's, designating the generation of chips. Instead of saying first generation, second generation, they come up with these rivers, you know. If you live in Oregon, you may know what it is, but you don't know which is first, who's on second, and so on. And I just want to tell you that Windows Redstone, and you're going to say, where do you get that from, is due for release the end of the year, another update.
Redstone.
Yeah, and you're saying, where'd you find that, right?
I'm saying the whole thing is getting silly. It's getting out of hand.
Well, the only thing I can't criticize Microsoft for is it's free.
It may be free, but, you know, I have a page here. It says the heading of it is Windows 10 Update History. Well, that's great. You know, it immediately tells you exactly what you've got. You know what I have?
One line.
1703. What the hell does that mean?
1503? No, 1511, you mean.
1703.
Oh, 1703. Okay, guess what? You just got the latest update.
Is that the Creator's latest update?
Correct.
Then why doesn't it say Windows 10 Creator's update?
You know what? If the left hand doesn't talk to the right hand in an organization, this is what you get. Hey, listen, Joe, I want to move on. I think that the population in the United States, I think 40% are millennials. In other words, those born, I think millennials is considered anyone born from 1990 on, something like that.
Oh, no, that's another thing. Microsoft must have set up that terminology because it doesn't mean anything. It means whatever that particular author wanted it to mean that particular day. There's no hard and fast rule on what a millennial is.
Well, the last time there was a solar eclipse was in 1991. And I would suspect that one-third of the population of the United States hadn't been born then. And I mentioned it to a number of people under the age of 27, 26. And the question is, what is a solar eclipse?
It's an eclipse of the sun.
And what does that mean?
Don't you speak the English language? I know you have problems with it. An eclipse is a closing over. And the sun, the solar, means the sun, which is the star of our particular solar system. The interesting thing is primitive peoples took the eclipse of the sun, a full eclipse, to mean something very much more serious than we do today. As recently as the last two solar eclipses ago, which was in round numbers 50 years ago, the Aboriginal people of Australia started praying very hard because they thought everything was going away. All light had closed down, and they had no assurance that there was going to be anything after that. That was the end of the planet, end of the solar system. Well, you know, that's very primitive.
Well, there's a reason why I brought it up, Joe, because you asked me a question. It says, what does the, by the way, the solar eclipse is going to occur August the 21st, and your question to me was, what does that have to do with personal computing? And I said to you that the last time there was a solar eclipse was in 1991, and we also happen to be in a period where there's a transition period on sunspots. And when you consider sunspots and a solar eclipse, I don't think anyone really knows what the impact is on communications.
What the impact will be is
we don't know.
Well, we don't know, but I would make a very strong and urge everybody, whatever God they believe in, they should really pray to, because it might mean the end of the solar system when all the light goes out.
Nah, come on. Listen, you're a pessimist and I'm an optimist, okay? And
what an optimist is, don't you, Hank?
Yeah, you know what the optimist says? If the glass is half empty, go fill it up.
And you know what I say is if the glass is half empty, go get a bigger glass.
No, what you say is when the glass is empty, fill it up with vodka and go drink it.
No, the problem, Hank, is that I don't really think you're a true believer.
In what?
In anything.
Oh, come on. You know I am.
If you were a true believer, you would know that when the solar eclipse comes, it really signals the end of the world.
No, listen, you know, when I spoke to you the other day, I had asked you in a perhaps a not serious way of, you know, what is a solar eclipse? I like that explanation a lot better. You said that is when Hades go around the Venus and so on. And you told me a nice fairy tale, and I couldn't quite remember it because I like to repeat that to my granddaughters, okay?
they probably are too sophisticated for us. Yeah. Story like that. How old are they now, your granddaughters?
Oh, they range in age from 5 months to 16.
Well, the 5 months might be more.
No,
on
no,
your
I'm sorry, not 5 months.
16
5 years.
Are probably
5 years.
Way past you.
5 years old. The youngest is 5 years old.
Five years.
Sharp as a whip. That's all I can say. Hey, Joe. Let me just.
Hank, I got to interrupt you.
Okay.
My screen was open to give me whatever information Microsoft was giving out on Windows 10. The screen just went black, and it popped open with this new window all by itself saying, new Windows features are almost here. We're preparing a new update. Let's start by reviewing your privacy settings right now.
Joe, this is what I mean by these updates is that if you're hard pressed, you need the machine to run. I don't have time to go through all that. Let me do it when I have spare time on a weekend, okay?
Well, you can also say that you don't want the update. It doesn't mean you won't get the update. It'll just be delayed a lot.
You got to remember, at least now they're asking. I would bet you that before the end of the year, they'll be pushing it, whether you want it or not.
Well, right now they're just saying if you want to be the first ones on the block, click here.
Yeah. By the way, have you taken the arrows out of your back yet?
No, they're still sticking me.
Hey, Joe, I mentioned something to you and you said to me, I didn't hear about that. Where'd you find that? And it's big news. It's Twitter. It's called Twitter Lite. And you say,
Wait a minute. It's called Twitter what?
Lite.
How do you spell that? Because I spell Lite, L-I-G-H-T.
I guess you never drank beer. It's L-I-T-E.
I don't like light beer.
Okay, that's why you didn't find the article on it, okay? But Twitter Lite is different. With Twitter Lite, instead of a full image that you can, send out, you can preview it. You can run it offline. You don't have to be online to run it, such as like in email. There are certain email systems that you can just do it offline instead of being online. And the whole idea is to cut down on the data transmission that's required because in third world countries, and, you know, the United States could end up being a third world country.
Very soon now.
Is that it costs. Now, in terms of...
Not so much that it costs, Hank. It's the question of speed.
Yes. Well,
in most third world countries, Twitter is running on 2G.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's just a bit better than dial-up speed.
Well, let me put it this way. There's an awful lot about this Twitter Lite, and we don't have time to cover it. So if anyone is really interested in what this Twitter Lite is that is being rolled out, do a search on Twitter space L-I-T-E. Because when I mentioned it to Joe, he says, I don't know what the heck you're talking about. And all of a sudden, when he changed the L-I-G-H-T to L-I-T-E, wow, did you get a lot of information.
Now, I suggest anybody who really wants to know about it, that one of the top two or three clicks, if you do a Google search, is to the Google blog, and that's where you're going to get the real dish on it.
Yeah, the Google blog is what you want. And you know what's interesting about it? You were, after you saw the Google blog, you thought that Twitter was owned by Google. It's not.
I somehow got confused when I thought Google, Hank, has taken over everything.
Well,
I knew they hadn't taken over Windows, but I thought they took over everything. They took over YouTube, and they took over so many things. They were the top search engine in the world. 40 or 45% of the people in the world use Google. And then you amazed me by saying they didn't own Twitter.
No one owns Twitter.
I thought about that for a few minutes, and then I realized why they don't own Twitter. It's not making any money.
I know, and right now they're trying to get someone to buy them, to buy them out. At first it was over $30 billion. Now it's down to $19 billion. They've yet to make any money at all.
Well, I'll tell you, Hank, I'm willing to buy it when they drop down to $1.36.
Well, the problem with Twitter is that it's useful. It's
fun.
It's functional. But how do you make money on it?
Well, I don't know. But every time there's a world catastrophe, an election or a war or whatever, I quick go over to Google to see what's trending. And I can very often feel like I'm right there on the site because people are tweeting right from the site, from the flood, from the war, from the victory parade, wherever they are. So Google is great.
No,
but
not Google, not Google. See, you made the mistake. It's not Google. It's Twitter.
Sorry, I said Google because we were talking that way. Twitter is a lot of fun. It doesn't cost me anything.
And if Twitter didn't exist, people would really miss it.
Some people would.
Yeah.
Would you?
No, not me. I'm a Luddite.
A long, long time ago, John called me and said, I've got to get onto this newfangled thing that's on the internet called Twitter. I said, what's it going to cost? He said, nothing. You just go on, you give them your name and you register, and it's absolutely free. This was about, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. And I did that. And when I signed on, I gave them my name, my password, and a screen appeared that said something to the effect of, what are you doing now?
Yep.
And I said, nothing. And I've been waiting ever since for an answer.
Hey, Joe, I know that you've mentioned that you have the Google Pixel, right? The phone?
I do. It's a smartphone, okay. Not a computer. And that smartphone has more power than the first computer I owned.
Now, have you heard of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development called OECD?
I've heard of it. I don't know much about it.
Okay. It's a trade organization, and they did they get a lot of reports, and they came up with a survey, and I was shocked by this survey, okay, that 1 in 5 mobile phones are counterfeit. In other words, if you had the opportunity...
Telling me if I buy 5 mobile phones, one of them are going to be counterfeit?
No, if you buy from the wrong source, it would be. In other words, I had said to you, where did you get a Google Pixel phone from? You said from Verizon.
Well, there was only 2 places I could get it from. One was from Google, and they were not shipping any, and the other was from Verizon, who incidentally was also not shipping any. I went into 2 Verizon stores, and they said, you know, eventually they'll get them. And then I went online to Verizon, and it said I could order it online, and I had it in my hands 5 days later.
And now what if you saw an ad that says you can get the Google Pixel phone for $200 less, unlocked from XYZ? Would you buy it?
Probably not, and only because I've had bad experiences buying batteries that way.
In other words, when you don't buy from a trusted source, 1 in 5 mobile phones are counterfeit. That is really an eye-opener because the trend now is that instead of going for a 1-year plan, 2-year plan, people are buying unlocked phones. You got to be careful where you buy it from, really. You just
first of all, on Verizon, you can't get a 2-year plan or a 1-year plan.
Well, they don't have that anymore, but now a lot of companies are selling unlocked phones.
Well, the Verizon phone is locked in the sense that it's got its little SIM card in there. But what Verizon has allowed me to do for no interest, an interest-free loan, is they allow me to pay off for my very expensive phone $25 or $28 a month.
Mm.
Now,
by the way,
the trick there is as soon as I leave Verizon to go someplace else,
mm-hmm.
and I would have to get a new SIM card, but I could do that. But the moment I leave Verizon, the balance due is due. I have to pay up immediately, however many hundreds of dollars is left on the charge.
Well, some people buy the unlocked phone in the beginning, so they don't have any of those charges. But they pay up front, though.
Yeah, and it's the same price because they're not charging any interest, and that's their hook for trying to get you to use their service, which we know is not necessarily the best service, but at the time it was the only service to run the Pixel.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I have a rule of thumb, Hank. I always recommend against buying version zero point anything. I never buy zero.
But wait a minute, you bought the Google Pixel, which is as close to zero as there it is.
You know something? I am so unhappy I broke my rule of thumb.
Hey, by the way, you know, in the last 6 to 9 months, you know what has been happening to the PC industry?
Yes, it's been going through the roof.
Well, not through the roof, but it no longer is there a drop in shipments. There's been increase in shipments. There have been increase in sales, increase in revenue, increase in profit.
Well, that's going through the roof.
Yes, in a way it is. And about 2-3 years ago, HP lost the lead to Lenovo to be the biggest PC manufacturer. Now HP has regained it.
But wasn't at some point Dell the leading seller?
At some point many years ago, but now the HP and Lenovo is by a fraction of a point, but percentage points ahead of number three, okay? But let me tell you what's interesting about it is that according to IDC, which is the one I go by because it's a total shipments worldwide, they have HP as a leading manufacturer of PCs in the world. The Gartner Group, which you know what that is, it's a separate group, they have Lenovo as the biggest PC manufacturer because they say that they do not recognize the Chromebook as being a computer.
Well, I got to tell you what my thinking on that is, Hank.
Now, wait a minute. Don't you trust Gartner, what they say?
When people say things to me that are particularly stupid, I not only don't believe their facts this time out, but they've lost all credibility with me for a long time coming. They may very well think the Chromebook is not a computer. I, on the other hand, don't think that Toyota is a car. It's not made in Japan. It's not made in Detroit, so it's obviously not a car.
Well, Joe, you got to understand that the reason why they don't consider the Chromebook a computer is businesses don't buy it. It's the education market. About 40-45% of the education market is K-12. They've been buying it. And you know the big reason why they buy it? Is because when the kids play around with it, there's a virus or whatever happens, very easy to do a factory reset and it's good as new.
How many, in a rough estimate, Hank, how many Chromebooks are sold every year?
I don't know the numbers, but I can give you a percentage, okay?
What percentage of the total computer sales?
5%. And let me put it this way. The last year, there were 63 million units, core PCs sold, okay? So 5% of that would be over 3 million.
And Gartner doesn't think that's a sale.
Well, because it's not in the businesses.
I'd like to meet one of the senior people at Gartner because I have this bridge that they might like to buy from me.
Well, I have to tell you, they also do not count tablets as a PC, whereas the biggest hit that's really been taking a beating because of the PC market went up are tablets. People are not buying tablets.
Let's hit that question for just a minute, Hank. How do you define a computer?
It has a CPU.
What, does my tablet have a CPU?
Sure.
How else do you define a computer?
The ability to have input and output.
Does my tablet have that ability?
Sort of. In other words, you have a virtual input keyboard, but not a real keyboard.
But it's a virtual keyboard. I can do input from it.
Well, you got to understand that businesses, they may buy tablets, but, ever since the Surface came out, that Microsoft came out, their big sales in PCs are the two-in-ones. In other words, if you take off the...
First of all, the Surface is a tablet. You can add on to it, but mm-hmm. a basic Surface 4 is a tablet. It's a lot more powerful. I have the A6 from Samsung, but it's a tablet. It's got a full keyboard. Granted, it's on screen, but I can use it. I have no trouble with it. I have input and output. I have voice input. I have, which I don't have on some of my other legitimate computers. It can compute. By that I mean it can perform mathematical formulae. It can compute. It can store. I have more storage on that A6 tablet than I had on my K Pro.
Joe, I got your point, okay? Hey, Joe, I just want to touch on one thing very quickly before I go into something else, and that is the fact that Google has a TV offering now on YouTube, and it's going to be rolled out in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, and Philadelphia. And I was going to cover, what you can download from YouTube, but since they have this new offering, they may be changing the protocol and so on. So we'll be talking about that maybe next week or the week after when we get more information on it. And I do want to get to the fact that we have Dr. Alfred Poor.
They're going to be offering regular television programming?
Yep, regular television programming, okay.
If I wanted to watch Channel 2?
Yep, okay. You're going to have ABC, CBS, Fox, NBC, and I can keep going on with a whole lot of channels that will be available.
YouTube?
For $35 a month, okay? But we'll have more on that next week.
Talk about cutting the cable. My heavens.
Joe, I want to tell you that I want to get to Dr. Alfred Poor. He's back with us this week on Wearable Tech. We have Joe Rejeski on Simple Computer Tips. People like to hear what he has to say. And we have Marty Winston on Home Automation. So we'll get to that right now. And Joe, take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. When patients are sick in the hospital, it's important to monitor their vital signs to make sure that their health isn't deteriorating. This is especially true with children. With pediatric patients, you need to keep close watch on them because their situation can change in a hurry. The traditional model is to use healthcare workers in the hospital to come around and manually take the vital signs of patients, but this only gives you snapshots in time. A more modern way to do it is to hook them up to machines that will monitor heart rate, breathing rate, and other factors, and report if anything goes awry. The problem is with very small children, this is uncomfortable for them. They can cause problems if they're moving about, and the wires can get tangled or give false readings. And that's why there's an experiment going on in England. It's a program called RAPID, which stands for Real-Time Adaptive and Predictive Indicator of Deterioration. This is being done at Birmingham Children's Hospital. It's being done with seriously ill children. And the program is built around a smart bandage, which measures heart rate, breathing rate, movement, and other important biometrics. And this smart bandage then reports that data wirelessly to a controller. And that then gets passed on to the healthcare workers in the hospital. The nice thing about this is that it can run for about 5 days without having to be replaced. So the data goes into the system where it's processed, and alerts are triggered only if the readings are outside of the preset boundaries that they have. The advantage here is it's much more comfortable for the child. Parents and staff can hold the child without disturbing the sensors, and it makes it a whole lot better for everybody. It's part of a 3-year study intended to provide data on the outcomes of patients treated under this system. Hopefully, we'll show the value, the cost savings, and the improved outcomes that can come from using a system like this. Not all wearable health technology sits outside your body, but there's all kinds of technology behind implants that are used commonly. For example, pacemakers to help your heart rhythms stay normal. There are cochlear implants to help people hear again. What about a prosthetic device to help people who have lost their vision? There are a lot of people working on this, but a group at the University of California at San Diego have come up with a novel approach. They've actually created a matrix of nanowires, tiny little wires that can convert light into electricity. They can use this as an implant on the retina of a patient who's lost their vision. And those nanowires will electrically stimulate the nerves directly so that the patient can see again. Couple the beautiful things about this approach is, one, the nanowires are very, very fine. They're microscopic. And so it has a much higher resolution than some of the silicon chip approaches that have been tried in the past. Another advantage is it requires no wires to the outside. It generates its own power in terms of stimulating the nerves, and controlling the device can be done through induction with a coil outside the head of the patient. So there's no need for any wires directly to the implant. This technology is being developed at this point. They're conducting animal trials, but they're hoping to work up to clinical trials in humans in the near future. It's going to be some time before this is available, but it certainly is an approach that holds great promise to help people see again. We're familiar with all kinds of wearable technology that we wear outside our bodies: heart rate monitors, breathing monitors, activity monitors. But we don't have a whole lot of experience, most of us, with devices that replace bodily functions that we can wear outside our bodies. One area where this could be very helpful is in the area of people who need lung transplants. More than 30,000 transplants were performed in the U.S. in 2015, which is a huge number. Patients with acute respiratory problems need lung transplants and may have to wait quite some time before a suitable donor becomes available. The way that these people are treated is they have to be hooked up to machines that essentially do the breathing for them. Their blood gets cycled through a machine that oxygenates it and takes out the carbon dioxide. Their blood can then go through the body and carry the oxygen where it's needed. These are large machines, and you have to be tied down to them in a clinical setting. Scientists at the University of Pittsburgh have developed a portable artificial lung. It's small enough that you can hold it in your hand. It could fit in a backpack. They've already done experiments to oxygenate real blood outside the body. They've done experiments with sheep and had good success. They've been able to oxygenate the blood of the sheep for 6 hours. All it needs is a power source and be connected to an oxygen supply. So the scientists are working towards developing a 5-day study for sheep, and the goal is to continue to reduce the size and weight of it so that it could be worn in a pack. Patients waiting for a lung transplant would be able to lead a fairly normal life, walking around with an artificial lung to carry with them wherever they go. This Thursday, April 13th, at 7 p.m., I will be presenting my program called Stay Home, Stay Safe, about how technology can help seniors stay home safely and live independently in their own homes. This is sponsored by the New York Amateur Computer Club and will be held at New York University at 32 Waverly Place, the Silver Building, in room 408. Again, that's Thursday, April 13th, 2017. At 7 p.m. There's no fee. It's a free program. However, you will need a photo ID in order to gain entrance to the NYU buildings. And again, it's sponsored by the New York Amateur Computer Club. If you want more details, you can find them at www.nyacc.org. That's www.nyacc.org. I hope to see you there. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred.
Are you using the same password for all the websites you log into? Well, this week on Simple Computer Tips for Busy People, we're going to show you that there's a much better alternative to password one. Hey, it's time for Simple Computer Tips for busy people like you. Yes, you. I'm Joe Rejeski, author of the soon-to-be-released Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Okay, Keeper Security analyzed the 10 million passwords of data breaches in 2016, and they listed on their website, keepersecurity.com, the most commonly used passwords. Guess which password was number one? The password 123456. And that was followed by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then QWERTY, Q-W-E-R-T-Y. And who could ever forget 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8? Clearly, most of us are not using secure passwords. It seems every day you hear about a website being hacked. But that's not stopping anyone from using these passwords, folks. If you use the same password for all your website accounts, if one of those websites is hacked, then a hacker could attempt to log in as you by using the same password at other websites. The solution is to have a unique, complex password for every single website. You know, passwords that are uppercase characters, lowercase characters, numbers, and special characters, all sorts of characters, characters left and right. But who can remember all those passwords? Well, that's why you need a password manager. What is a password manager, say ye? I will tell ye. A password manager is an application that seamlessly works with your web browser. Password manager creates very complex passwords and unique passwords for every website you visit. Also, your password manager will remember the URL for each website that requires a password. Then, whenever you want to log into a website, just click the shortcut in the password manager for the website, and it will automatically log you in with your unique username and password. It actually takes less time to log into a website than if you could remember your login name and password, because the password manager will automatically enter that information for you. You don't have to type it. One of my favorite features is password managers can also remember things like your address, phone number, and email address. So you can have the password manager automatically enter that information every time it's required for a website. For example, whenever you have something shipped to your home, have the password manager quickly enter your name, address, telephone number, and email address so you don't have to type that stuff. Also, you can store credit card numbers in your password manager. So whenever you make a purchase online, your password manager will enter all the credit card information for you. Now you're probably thinking, how secure is a password manager, right? If my password manager is compromised, then all my passwords and credit card information will be accessible. Well, there is some element of risk to any approach you take with online security. However, the way it works with a password manager is all your passwords are encrypted with one master password. It's the key to accessing all your complex passwords. You memorize one complex password, and your password manager remembers all the rest. When you create your master password for your password manager, the password needs to be complex. And for this one, you need to memorize it. Don't make the mistake of writing it down or emailing passwords to yourself or others. One email passes through a number of servers where someone could potentially access the email. Anyway, two popular password managers are LastPass and 1Password. LastPass maintains an encrypted copy of all your passwords on their web servers, so you don't need to back up the encrypted file. Theoretically, if someone was to hack into the LastPass website, they would not be able to access your password file because only you have the master password for the encrypted file. Another password manager option is 1Password. 1Password does not store your password file on their servers. You manage your password file, so if your hard drive crashes, you would lose your password file unless you're able to restore from backup. However, 1Password recommends maintaining your password file in a Dropbox or iCloud folder, so the file is automatically copied to the cloud. A word of caution on using a password manager: even if you're using a password manager, I recommend memorizing important passwords, such as banking passwords. You always want to be able to access your online banking at a moment's notice, particularly if for some reason an issue arises with your password manager and you are unable to access your data. There you go. That's this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Do you have a computer tip for me? Let me know. Just visit www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com. I'm Joe Brzezinski. Over and out.
Thank you, Joe. Public service announcements. New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Stay Home, Stay Safe, How Technology Helps Seniors Remain in Their Own Homes. By the way, that presentation is by our very own Dr. Alfred Poor, Thursday, April the 13th. Meeting starts at 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building in room 408. Long Island Mac Users Group, Friday, April the 14th, meeting time starts at 7 p.m., New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located on Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane. They meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Schurer Hall. The Princeton PC Users Group will have a presentation on Create Your Website or Blog Site, and the meeting date is April the 25th at 7 p.m., and it's held at the Community Room of the Princeton Public Library in Princeton, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on Scary Alphabet Soup. In this case, they're referring to Google when they say alphabet. They meet on Thursday, April the 27th, Starting meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Middletown Township Public Library, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on drones and radio control technology. Tuesday, May 2nd at 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Computer Learning Center of Ewing will have a presentation on how to buy a personal computer, the gamut from smartphone to desktop. Tuesday, May 2nd, 2 p.m., Community Room, 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Westchester PCs Users Group will have a presentation on Eat Well, Think Clearly, and Live Fully. May 4th, 7 p.m. is the meeting time at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their main meeting on Friday, the May 5th, 8 p.m., at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Rockland PC Users Group will have their meeting on Tuesday, May 9th, 7:15 p.m. at the Rassel Room on the Palisades Mall, 4th floor, West Nyack, New York. All these meetings are open to the public. They hope that you're going to be able to make some of them.
One thing about building a 40-year house that's ultra-automated, 40yearhouse.com has info about our project, is that you never know what you don't have. You never know what you need to add until it comes time, and then, wait a minute, where are we going to get that one? You know, it's not as much fun as it should be. So what I thought I'd do today is go over something we found, and then several things that we haven't found and hope somebody out there can help us. What we found, what we were looking for, is a way to do electrical insulation that could protect small circuit boards where we've done our prototyping, or in some cases, connections between things. And of course, you know, there's heat shrink tubing, and that's fine, and that does pretty well. And initially, when we built some of our boards, we wrapped them in electrical tape, in vinyl tape, and that was okay. But that's not the ultimate, most thorough way to do stuff. Now, anybody remember potting? You still see it. Relays come potted. Other things come potted. Little modules. It's just a little chunk of epoxy with pins sticking out. You can't see the electronics inside. My first exposure was when we bought military surplus stuff in the 60s. It would come in that little wax paper envelope. You pull it out, it's got a blob of what was probably melted Bakelite back then. Well, one up from potting is a thing called conformal coatings. You've seen it on electronics. It's it's not candy. I like to call it a thin candy shell. It's armor. It's really... Well, initially it was lacquer, but these days it's usually urethane. And I wanted to find a good urethane conformal coating. I didn't think I would. I thought, oh, forget that one, off the table. But no, I found CRC has a lovely aerosol spray. There it goes. You got a conformal coating. It's tacky for a little bit, but within 72 hours, it's forever, man. It's just... there. Okay, so I found that. What have I not found? Well, one thing that I'm hoping to find is a really inexpensive little radar unit. I can use LIDAR to measure distances along a narrow beam. I can use ultrasonics to measure distances, shorter distances. It's a little more range limited. For things like knowing whether a thing on the ceiling of the garage is seeing the garage door or the top of a vehicle or the floor of the garage, and those things are good information. So we've got lines of 5 ultrasonic in the garage. Radar would give me a little better range. It would give me more of the yard. Radar also gives me yet another way to confirm that something that seems to have been sensed by other sensors really is there. I can look for coincidental detection. So if anybody knows of a good little radar module, or sometimes even a bad little radar module, boy, I'd love to find a way to play with that to see if it can enhance what we're doing. Water flow is another issue. Some way of sensing how much or how little water is going through pipes, because tracking that information lets us figure out if we have, for example, toilet flappers leaking, if we have a leak at a washer, at a spigot somewhere. It may not be practical. It may be that, you know, 40 or 50 places to track water in a house, there could be that many pipes, I suppose, is too big a charge to buy things to track. But if you know of an economical way, economical, reliable, long-lasting way to find out how much water is flowing down a line, again, I'd love to know about it. Toilet levels, there are a couple of cute little things out there that are good at figuring out whether that flapper thing, the phantom flushes thing, is happening. Unfortunately, so far, they work in place. You know, they have a coin cell battery. They have three little LEDs. They light up to tell you. And that is okay for people, but not okay for automation. I'm hoping to find some way to add telemetry to it. So, for example, if a toilet starts doing phantom flushing, we can turn off. A solenoid valve is easy. Turn off the water to that toilet, but we also know when people are and are not in the room. So we can turn the water back on if somebody wants to use the toilet, be a mess otherwise. I think I've mentioned this earlier. One thing that really, really interests me, we've got smoke detectors, we've got temperature sensors, we know when there's a fire inside the house, we can respond to it. We don't know when there's an exterior fire, when trees catch fire, when there's a brush fire, when one of the neighbors catches fire. If you know of some reasonable way, some fairly reliable way that is not overly costly to get alerted to a fire that is within the view of something outdoors, you know, maybe that's a nice infrared heat sensing kind of thing. But if I'm looking for an exterior fire sensor. If you know about that, let us know. And for that matter, if you work for one of the companies that build smoke alarms, it's not a terrible thing. Think about all the people in California who go through those brush fires and the trees on fire and whole neighborhoods get smoky. If they know that's coming, you may be able to save them some grief. So if you know about that, let us know about it. You know, I'll try to get one in for review. If I can work it in the house, terrific. If all I can do is tell people about it, that's not bad either. Now, here's one that I think will make a lot of people jealous. I don't know if it's out there. I'm hoping to find some kind of minimal trash can trolley. We get 60 to 98 pound, or gallon rather, trash cans. They're on two wheels. And a trash can down a 10-foot, 20-foot driveway is not a big deal. We've got 400 feet from the house to the street. And it's on a hill. So it sure would be nice to have something motorized that could just kind of take the trash can, help us walk it down, help us walk it back. The good news is that going to the street is downhill. So when it's full, the trash can will probably drag us down. When it's time to return it, that's uphill, but the trash can's empty at that point. So if I never find the trash can trolley, it's not a huge big deal. But, brother, I'd love to find it, wouldn't you? That's pretty much all I have this week, except, of course, if we do find the trash can trolley, when we put it in reverse, would you rather have it go beep, 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 or have Hank's voice saying, back up, back up, back up?
Thank you, Marty. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org. And we communicate via Twitter at PC Radio 212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.